Now might I say this, that if one was choosing a section of the Bible upon which to preach a sermon, one would not be likely to choose Genesis chapter 34. But we are not choosing portions for sermons to make them acceptable to a congregation. Neither are we seeking to promote the speaker and make him popular. What we are seeking to do is to go through this book chapter by chapter and seek to learn the lesson that God would have us learn. So therefore, you have to take the passage as it comes, whether it is a chapter of warning, or a chapter of rebuke, or a chapter of promise. We just move on, link by link, and seek to learn the lesson. Now before we look at this chapter, let us bow for prayer. Our Father, be with us now. And we ask in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, that as we look at this solemn portion of thy word, thou shalt prepare our hearts, that we may not turn away from what thy word has to say, but help us, O God, to be good disciples, to be good followers, ready to lend our ear to what the Master has to say, and to learn our lesson therefrom. Be with each listener now and bless them wherever they may be. We ask all, giving thanks in the Savior's name. Amen. Now chapter 34 is the sad and mournful sequel to what was recorded in chapter 33. In chapter 33, we mention certain things regarding the failures of Jacob. For example, he got stuck, as it were, at Shechem. And the fact that he remained at Shechem when he ought to have gone on to Bethel is now going to lead him and his family into an awful tragedy. This chapter that we're now looking at, chapter 34 of Genesis, is a chapter of compromise, a chapter of crime, a chapter of cruelty. Now, these are three things that perhaps we don't like to consider. We'd rather close our eyes to that which relates to compromise and crime and cruelty. But they're here before us in a chapter, and they're written there for our instruction. And the events of this chapter leave an indelible mark on the mind of Jacob. He remembers the incidents recorded here right to his dying day. He's never going to forget what his sons have done. Let me note about six things you can look at in the chapter. First of all, there is the danger at Shechem. Then we're faced with the desire of Dinah, the only daughter of Jacob. Then there is the defilement of Dinah. Then the deceit of Jacob's sons. The disgrace upon Jacob himself. And the distress that disturbed Jacob. Looking at the danger at Shechem, this links us back to what we studied in a previous chapter, but these principles are brought on into chapter 34, for Jacob is still in Shechem. So the first danger here is the danger of a prosperous position. If things had not looked well for Jacob at Shechem, he would not have remained there. But of course, it was going to suit him to be there. He got a place for his cattle, he built booths there, and settled down at Shechem. He was not supposed to do that. He was supposed to go on to Bethel, the house of God. But somehow or another, this was going to be a prosperous place for him, so he thought. And in his prosperous position, he failed to recognize there were dangers. And you know, there's always danger when we set our eyes on that which is going to prosper us in material things. If the material thing is to take the prominent place over the spiritual, you can rest assured we're in the place of danger. The things of God, the spiritual things, ought to take first place. Jacob here put the material advantage first. Then there was the danger of a mere religious profession without reality. I pointed out that he erected an altar there. Quite a religious man. Wasn't an atheist. He had his altar, but he raised his altar and he called it the God of Israel. Plain words, to the people of the land, that simply meant he was worshipping his own God. He didn't tell them he was worshipping Jehovah. He was simply worshipping the God of Israel, and he was Israel. There's a danger, then, of having simply a mere religious profession without any reality. I wonder how many people today are putting on a religious profession just to look good in the eyes of their neighbors, just to give them some kind of prestige in the town, or with the people with whom they mingle, and they put on a kind of religious profession. And may I ask every listener today, do you have reality? Remember this, religion without reality is just a lot of rubbish. That's all. What we need today is reality. If we don't have the real thing, then we're only putting on a hypocritical show. Then there was the danger of a forgotten promise. He was going back to Bethel, but he's forgot that now. He promised God that he would come back in that very place where he had erected his stone. He would come back there and worship, make that the house of God. Remember this, when we make promises to God, we ought to be ready to keep them. See then the danger that he was in while abiding at Shechem. I wonder how many of my listeners today are living in the same dangerous atmosphere. The danger of being in a prosperous position without God. Then the danger of having a mere religious profession, but not having the reality. Then the danger of forgotten promises. Promises you've made to God, and perhaps promises you've made to men, and the promises were never kept. If we make promises to God and we don't keep those promises, you can rest assured, my friend, we're living in danger. Now see what all this led to. We're introduced now to his daughter, Dinah. We have learned already, of course, that he had one daughter, and at this particular time he had 11 sons, later on 11 other sons. But at this time he has 11 sons and one daughter. May I suggest that the opening verses of the chapter, where it says, "And Dinah the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob." You remember Leah was the first wife. Then this daughter went out to see the daughters of the land. Now pause there a moment and you'll come to this conclusion. You'll say, well, nothing wrong with that. One young girl desiring the company of other young girls. Looks all right on the surface. But verse 2 says, "And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her." That is, he humbled her. Now then, from there then, we're going to learn something of the desire of Dinah leading to the defilement of Dinah. I suggest that her age and circumstances would prompt the desire. She was a young woman. And the circumstances were such she had no sisters. But here were other young women in the land, and no doubt she thought she would like to have the company of the other young girls. Now the second thing I mention here is this, that her father and mother appeared to be indifferent to the danger. They didn't see anything wrong with Dinah going out and mixing with the girls of the land. Now remember, If her parents hadn't stayed there, if they had gone on to where they were supposed to go, Dinah would have been unable to have gone out and mingled with these other girls. But because her parents stayed there, they put the temptation right in front of their daughter. So they must accept some of the blame. And they appear to be indifferent to the danger. May I ask all parents today, are you interested, or are you quite indifferent as to the company that your children keep? Do you just allow them to choose their own company, or do you try to guide them in this matter? Because if you allow them just to choose their own company, they may be choosing the wrong company and getting into trouble. I think parents have a responsibility of being interested in the company that their children keep. I know when I was a boy growing up, if I wasn't in by a certain time at night, and if I was to tell the audience now what time that was, perhaps our young folks would be shocked. But if we weren't in by a respectable hour, my father wanted to know where we had been and who we were with. And you can rest assured he would know before he went to bed. And so therefore he was quite interested in what company we were keeping and where we were going. Now I think parents have a right to know, because here in Genesis chapter 4, this very principle is brought before us. Then the other thing that prompted the desire of Dinah was this. The young people in the area seem to have promoted the desire, because we must beware of allowing social relationships with immoral tendencies. See, it's obvious that if she was going out with the young ladies of that area, there were young men who were interested in them. Well, you say that's a natural thing. Yes, it may be. But then there's a right and a wrong way in which this should be done. And so far as Dinah was concerned, she got into company where they were doing the wrong thing. They were doing that which was contrary to God's standards. And you find very soon that one of the well-respected fellows in the area who had a good position, notice who he was. He was Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country. She wasn't going out with a riffraff, you know. Oh, no. She was going out with the best. And if this is a sample of the best, I begin to wonder what the worst were like. Here was a prince in the country. And the first thing he did, he set his eyes on her, took her aside, and defiled her. Now, parents, might I say this? If your children are being defiled morally, or should I say immorally, perhaps you have failed. It may be you failed to instruct them. It may be you have failed to guide them. Because it's worth noting here regards the defilement of Dinah. I want you to notice this. The word rendered defiled in verses 5, 13 and 27, you could note them in this chapter, verses 5, 13 and 27, you have this word defiled. It's a word which means desecrated, and is used later to describe the defilement or the desecration of the temple. You'll find it in Psalm 79, verse 1. Therefore, on the strength of that, we conclude that God considers the dishonor of womanhood and the desecration of the Holy of Holies with the same abhorrence, and describes them with the same word. You see, some people might not even think of the idea of going into the very Holy of Holies in God's temple and destroying that holy place. No, but they're prepared to destroy and defile and desecrate a pure woman. And God looks upon the two things as being one and the same. The man who's prepared to defile a woman would also be looked upon by God as one who goes in and prepared to desecrate the very Holy of Holies. So therefore, my friend, remember this. The defilement of womanhood is something that God abhors. But then you follow on here and you come to what we call the deceit of Jacob's sons. Now remember that the man who defiled Dinah was quite willing to marry her. And at verse 9, you find the man coming and saying, "Make ye marriages with us, and give your daughters unto us, and take our daughters unto you. Let's have mixed marriages. You Israelites, don't keep yourselves separate from us. Let us mix up. If you're going to dwell in land, let us all be one. Ye shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade ye therein, and get you possessions therein." However, the sons of Jacob thought otherwise. Verse 13, "And the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father deceitfully, and said," because he had defiled Dinah, their sister, "they said unto them, we cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one that is uncircumcised, for that were a reproach unto us. But in this will we consent unto you, if ye will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised, then will we give our daughters unto you. We will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people." Now, if you were to continue to read on that particular section, here's what you'll find. First of all, there's the proposal of Hamor and Shechem. Now, this appears genuine enough, and the best to be expected from people of low moral standards. According to their own standards, they made a plain offer. Seems to be all right. But notice the pretext of Dinah's brothers. The hypocrisy of making a religious excuse in order to cover up their real motive and intentions. They said, "You see, we have a different kind of religion from you. And before we can mix with you in marriage, there's something you'll have to do. You'll have to accept our covenant sign, which is our religious sign with God. So if you accept our kind of religion, we'll do it. We'll agree with you." This was compromise. But it was more than compromise. It was deceitful. They had no intentions of doing it. You see, I wonder how many people, though, have compromised like this. They know perfectly well that what they're doing is not right. And yet they're quite willing to say, "Well, we'll compromise. If you'll accept my religion, believe what I believe, we'll get married all right." And so they compromise. My friend, things of that nature can never be blessed by God. Now notice the plot completed by Jacob's son. Now notice it was the actions of Simeon and Levi, two of Jacob's sons. Now what they did could never be excused, and they simply brought more grief to the heart of Jacob. Because while the men agreed to the sign of circumcision, it came to pass when the men were sore that the two sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren, took each man his sword, came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. And they slew Hamor, and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword, took Dinah out of Shechem's house, and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and spoiled the city, because they had defiled their sister. They took their sheep, and their oxen, and their asses, that which was in the city, and that which was in the field, and all their wealth, and all their little ones, and their wives, took they captive, and spoiled even all that was in the house. You see, the whole thing was this. It was a plot. And remember, it was a sinful plot. It was deception behind all this. And Simeon and Levi never were excused for it. They were wrong. And it didn't bring the blessing of God. It brought a lot of grief to the heart of their father. Here was the disgrace upon Jacob. Now remember, he in the first place was wrong in staying there, and now he's got to pay the price. First of all, the virgin daughter of Israel had been defiled by a Canaanite. What is his grace? Jacob would never forget it. Then the sons of Jacob deceived and murdered the Canaanites, and that was inexcusable. Again, Israel's religious profession was destroyed among the people. What would you think of this man? If that's how he acted, how can we possibly listen to him? So you see, my friend, sorrow upon sorrow is heaped upon Jacob at this time. And that disgrace brought distress. The distress that disturbed Jacob. For once again, Jacob is overcome with worry. Like a fugitive, he must gather all his possessions and his family and run from the area. Now gather up a little. He ran away from home in the first place because he was afraid of his brother who had vowed to kill him. After 20 years in Padan Aram, he ran away from his uncle and took all he could take. Now, where could he go? His brother came out to meet him and he promised he would come to his brother at Seir, but refused to go there. He had no intentions of going. He deceived his brother. He settled down at Shechem. He's in trouble again. Where can he go now? He's got to move. That's obvious. Now, he can't go back to Padan Aram because he pledged to Uncle Laban not to return. You remember they erected the pillar. Uncle Laban wouldn't pass there to come after Jacob, and Jacob wouldn't pass there to go back. So he couldn't go back to Padan Aram. Again, what can he do? He cannot go south lest he encounter brother Esau. He's afraid of him and he's deceived him again, so he can't go south to brother Esau. In the midst of all the confusion of circumstances, he desperately needs guidance from God. It is right here at the point of Jacob's extremity that God breaks in and reminds Jacob of an old standing promise, and Jacob begins to prepare for the return to Bethel. Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "Ye have troubled me to make me to stink among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And I being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed, I and my house." And they said, "Should he deal with our sister as with an harlot?" And now we come to the point where Jacob is ready to return to Bethel. When you come to chapter 35, you'll find it's God that's speaking to Jacob. He gives him directions. He says, "Arise, go up to Bethel." Or perhaps at this point, our thoughts go to the writer of that hymn who said, "Lead me gently home, lead me gently home, in life's darkest hours, when life's troubles come. Keep my feet from wandering, lest from thee I roam, lest I fall upon the wayside, lead me gently home." That's exactly where God is leading Jacob, leading him back home by way of Bethel, the house of God.